You're listening to the Two Tongues Podcast. And now your hosts, Kyle and Chris.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, the Two Tongues Podcast proudly presents to you its co-hosting champions of the world, Kyle and Chris. And today we have a guest who I have developed a little bit of a relationship with on X and Twitter formally, Jason Myronchuk, who Chris asked me to like kind of give me or give him a rundown of what you kind of do on the internet. And I told him that you talk about a lot of the same kind of stuff that we do, especially when we're together, and that you have consistently, you're one of the only people on X whose opinions I really am interested in hearing. A lot of people, it's kind of boring and the same thing over and over again. So I'm really excited to have you on, Jason, and get to the bottom of this vengeful son, excuse me, theory. So, Chris, you wanna say anything?
Well, yeah, I just wanted to say thanks for coming on, man. We appreciate it. So you and I had some exchanges on X a little bit, and I went and watched one of your episodes that I think it was titled Vengeful Son, just in preparation for today. But kind of where this started was Kyle and I getting into the Asha Logos stuff. So Kyle was talking a bit about Asha Logos and asked me to give it some attention. So I ended up watching it and doing a podcast episode on it. And then you commented on that, there's something about the spirit of the vengeful son. And, you know, that rings a bell. It resonates with me. And so I'm just curious. I'm going to put the ball in your court, Jason. This is something you've been talking about for some time. So why don't you give us the rundown?
Well, first of all, thank you, gentlemen, for the nice introduction. I appreciate it. So vengeful son. Okay. So I was listening to Pete Quinones and having a few talks with Paul Fahrenheit in 2023. And they were talking about the spirit of the age. And there's different ways you can kind of understand what a spirit of the age is. Like historically, the term was first coined to kind of talk about powerful men in England who sort of like, you know, the elites, right? The rising elites who kind of were presenting the spirit of that age. It was coined as, someone correct me, it was in somewhere in the 19th century. And then it's been used in more of a Hegelian term to kind of talk about the zeitgeist. So right. Something like we can say, zeitgeist, egregores, if we want to go Girardian, we can say like mimetic contagions, something that's like an over, like a meta, right? Something that is that people start to act and react to in similar ways. And you can kind of see patterns emerge in behavior. So it's not a catch. It's not like a 100%. It's not, you know, not everyone is going to do the exact same things, but you kind of see people acting in sort of understandable or recognizable patterns. So I started thinking about that, and one of the things they were talking about is what the new spirit of the age will be. And I had started seeing things. I'll work backwards on this. So I had started seeing little things that made me start thinking that there's definitely a major shift happening, and the shift is going to be much more masculine, and it's going to be far more aggressive. The example I like to use is the Game Stonks situation. I always flub this up in terms of detail, so I'll let people go Google that. It would happen in about 2021, I believe, just during the lockdowns and pandemics. Essentially, what had happened was a bunch of anons on the internet found out that a hedge fund was shorting GameStop. So, like, it was predatory behavior. Like, they're basically like killing the business out, expecting to like make money off the death of the business. Those anons got together and basically started to, and I'm going to say this probably incorrectly, but forgive me, they started to short the shorters. They started to short the hedge fund. And this was all legal, completely, you know, above board, something that you could do, but just people didn't do it before. And it actually started to raise the value of GameStop stocks. So they started calling it Game Stonks to like some ludicrous amount. And because of doing that, it started hurting the hedge fund. So the hedge fund started to like just, you know, get brutalized in the market, to the point where the app that they were kind of associated with or doing business with, Robinhood, had to put a stop to started doing extra legal things and had to actually go to Congress, and Congress had to change investment law on the fly to deal with this thing, because it was, the worry was like, oh God, what if they start doing this to more places? I say all that to get to this one point. It was, they were talking to one of the Anons about it, and they said to him, like, look, because part of the whole thing was hold the stonks, right? Like, hurt them, basically. Mm-hmm. Don't sell out. Keep the price elevated. It's only hurting the hedge fund. Let them let that happen. And they went to one of the organizers and said, you know, if you keep doing this, if you keep holding your position, you're going to lose all your money eventually. Like, it's how it's going to play out. Mm-hmm. And he said something along the lines of, I don't care. I don't care about making money. It's about hurting them, because these are the people who hurt my dad in 2008 and 2009. And that stuck with me, because like, that's almost abnormal behavior, right? Like, typically you do the kind of this kind of thing, you know, and you'll make your money and get up quick and whatever. But there was a definite movement within that GameStop's movement of like, no, we're going to hurt these people. And that got me thinking about violence in a different way, because so with when I say things like the vengeful sun and the spirit that's coming in, I think it's going to be like a totalizing violence. So it's going to be violence across the board in many dimensions. It won't be just kinetic. So it won't be things like just, you know, physical violence. It's going to be aggression everywhere. Mm. Elon Musk telling Disney, you know, Bob Iger and co, to go F themselves, yes. Right? That's vengeful sun. There's been like, I have a whole folder of this stuff, right? And you'll see on X, if you follow me on X at 2Bit Podcast, I'll mention it, and people are starting to memetically mention it all the time now. Mm-hmm. It's a nifty little term, right? It's the even just the term vengeful sun makes you go, what?
Yes, what? It does.
Right? Absolutely. So to go backwards on this, I think that the vengeful sun spirit is the offspring of two other dominant spirits that we saw in the 20th century. The tyrannical father of the earliest 20th century, all through World War I and World War II, which kind of dissipated around 1950s. And then the devouring mother, which everyone, if you ever followed Peterson, is glad you've heard, from the 1960s until relatively recently. I would say, like, let's say 2020, just for a date. These are sort of inverted patterns of these terms come from more of a Jungian concept of archetype. Mm-hmm. So if we take the wise father, the shadow version of the wise father becomes the tyrannical father. The divine mother, the shadow of the divine mother, or the inversion of the divine mother, becomes the devouring mother. The prodigal son, right? The shadow of the prodigal son becomes the vengeful son, right? So this is the danger of this, especially with the vengeful son, and especially for anyone who maybe is like us, or who's getting fed up, or who's getting like to the point of like woke needs to go away and all that stuff, is that the vengeful son's going to feel good. It's going to feel right. Mm-hmm. And it's not. It's not the right thing. It's an inversion of what the right thing should be, right? If we think of the most perfect example of the prodigal son, which is Christ, right? If you just want to take that model, that's the ideal prodigal son. And there's other versions of it throughout literature and history and myth and all that kind of stuff. But just take that. Well, what's the inversion of Christ? Right? So this gives credence to a lot of Orthodox fathers and other people who are saying that we're entering a very dangerous age of Antichrist. Now, I'm not saying that that means the Antichrist will rise and show himself, and this is the eschaton, the end of all ends. But I also believe that spirit can imbibe, and I mean, maybe that it ends that way. People keep asking, "What comes after the vengeful son?" I'm like, I don't know, but it's either the end of all ends, or we're going to flip the table back to something decent. People have been floating the term "the virgin daughter" around. I'm like, yeah, maybe.
Sounds hopeful.
I don't know. I prefer that version. Yeah, but That's kind of where we're at. And so, yeah. And this all kind of comes down to when I started writing the piece on X and on my Substack, I've trailed it back to, because my intuition was like something happened in the mid 19th century that kind of changed things. And you see like this big flush of Darwin and Mills and all these like liberal postmodernists and all that. Something happened there. And I was trying to figure out what it was. And in my research for this, I got to the liberal revolution that happened around 1848, where liberal revolutionaries that had won out in America, Britain, France, Haiti, a few other places, tried to do the same push in Italy, Germany, and a few other places in Europe, and got shut down partly because of Christendom being very powerful there and the monarch going, no, we're not doing that. Those guys didn't pack up and go home. They just, I think, started to imbibe darker spirits, if you want to go in that terminology. And that's what got us to the 20th century, which also solves the problem. Thomas 7-7 once said on my show that the 20th century has to be viewed as an anomaly. It's a weird historical century. There's almost like nothing like it ever. And yeah, that solves for that too, because that there's liberalism going, no, we're going to win. And I don't care how we win, we're going to win this way. So then they invoke the tyrannical father, and then you get all the repercussions thereafter. Hopefully that makes.
Oh yeah,
it's a jumble of things, but I hope that kind of lays it out a little bit.
Yeah, Chris and I got together yesterday to kind of talk about, you know, the Vengeful Son stuff, and you know, come up with what we were going to talk about. And he brought up that in Jungian, you know, in all of his theories, there's a spirit, but that spirit has the other side of it, and mm-hmm. and you know, you just hit that right on the head right out of the gate.
Yeah, in fact. In fact, you took so much of my thunder, Jason. You took so much of my thunder.
Sorry, man. We can dig into any part of it.
Oh no, absolutely.
I just feel like I feel like laying it out this way it's more wordy. I like to talk, so it's part of my thing. But I don't think there's any other way of doing it. I'm writing it in chunks. There should be a new one up. I keep saying this. It'll happen this week, but it will happen this week. Where I'm going to go into the tyrannical father a lot more, and you know, we can pick any part of this and deep dive into it and start to see where how these things function, because I think it feels right. People respond to it like it's right. Like the response on this has been really interesting, because I have three things kind of floating out there right now: Vengeful Son, Neo-Trads, and Civilizational Capital. And
Trads, man.
Yeah, Neo-Trads. Neo-Trads and Vengeful Son are very connected. But, and even to a certain extent, Civilizational Capital, Composite Crisis stuff, but with Gundo. But anyways, let's put this over here. Where was I saying? Yeah, if I try to just parse it out in smaller chunks, especially when I'm talking about it, it's like it's too all over the place. So I think that's kind of how I put it. Like, it's, think of it this way: revolutionary spirit hits the wall in 1848, regroups, pushes out the tyrannical father. That's operating until the 1960s. In response to the tyrannical father, devouring mother comes along from the 1960s until 2020. Wokeism is like the zenith of the devouring mother. It's like it's in its full form.
Mm-hmm, 100%.
And then now we're seeing that energy go away. It's being transferred, and it's being transferred to the Vengeful Son. And that's what's going to be dominating us for the next, I would say, 60 years. I you know, whatever. That seems to be the time frame, 50, 60 years.
Do you think that these switchings between, you know, the spirits of the age, do you think that they're connected in any ways to like a circulation of the elite, you know, like, you know, the elites back in the that 1848 revolution period, they, you know, they kind of were, I don't want to say knocked out of power, because I don't know that that ever really happens so much, but just that different powers were taking hold and that's what caused that shift? Or do you think that it's something different completely?
So the difficulty of answering that question is how you want to approach the question in the first place. So on a purely materialistic realm, right, if we're talking just pure psychology, then, or let's say Girardi mimetics, right, which is a bit more metaphysical, but hang with me, then what we're looking for is models. So we could say that this, right, let's say you're a liberal revolutionary in 1848. You do this big push to get, let's say, you know, global European liberalism across the continent and basically across the Western world, with the intention of it of making it global, because you have all the rest ideas and this is how you're going to fix everything and down with God and God is dead and yada, 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 right? Then you hit this wall of Christendom and can't move any further. So now you're left with a choice, either give up or regroup and have a different kind of attack. I think they chose the latter, and then it's like, okay, well, how do you bring down Christendom, right? How do you weaken this regio to be able to replace it? And I mean, World War I, the Great Depression, World War II, World War I was an atheist factory. Yep. And it explains why, to a certain extent, why a lot of American, a lot of these people who had already gone through the liberal revolution were so savage, like using mustard gas and like crazy methods that we look back on and no one talks about, but it's all there. Mm-hmm. And if you're my age, we learned about it in history class. I don't know what they're teaching kids now, but you look back on that and go, why would they do that? It doesn't make any sense. And it's like, oh yeah, it makes sense if you want to break people's spirit. If you want to make people doubt God, you know, down to the average man, that'll work. Like you basically create hell on earth and you go live in it for, what was it, 4 or 5 years. Like, you know, it's insanity. Yeah, and then you have the Great Depression, which was, and the Dust Bowl and all that stuff, which I think did a lot of damage. Mm-hmm. And then, because then you start seeing writers like Hemingway, Faulkner, a few other people who are certainly, let's say, of a certain bent. Hemingway was a full-on communist, and not shy about doubting God in his books. And it's all subversive, right? Henry Miller, all these writers coming up in the 1930s, 1940s. It's all the subversive literature. Even James Joyce is an attack on the concept of God and your relationship to God. And again, you don't have to be a Christian to care about this, but it's like, this is how this deteriorates so that it can replace it. And then World War II, for the Jews and a whole bunch of other people, it was an atheist factory. And people came out of that going, yeah, we're done with this. Like, you know, and then you introduce marbles and all these other great things that are not built by the church, but built by man. You know, this is the push. Yeah. So then you come out of those two wars and a Great Depression with now two solid generations of men who've been militarized, who've been scandalized, who've been psychologically screwed with, who have just come through the Industrial Revolution. So they're working in factories, they're divorced from their families, they're spending less and less time with their families. Now they're psychologically broken, of those who survived. And then you're wondering where does this toxic masculinity come from? Well, it comes from that, because suddenly you have men modeling to their children emotionally distant, broken behavior. And so then you get the boomer men who are either modeling that directly or trying to do something different, right? Trying to get away from that because it's abusive.
Yeah,
you know, the tyrannical father is, I use the image of Saturn, you know, or Kronos from the Greek and Roman traditions, who eats his children so that, because he's afraid of them getting more powerful than him. Right? Like, that's the perfect image of the tyrannical father, of someone who's just like crushing you know, imposes rules and and is just heartless. You know, I look at my grandfather's generation and like, I love my grandfather, but not perfect, you know, by any means. So yeah, that starts it. And then from a mimetic trend, well, then just it's a series of actions and reactions. So it's like, I guess the question is like, who's in control? Are the elites in control of this? I don't think so. I think maybe some of them might be aware of it. Mm-hmm. Probably not maybe in these terms, but they're aware of certain things and how to manipulate it. But they're a subject to this as well. Yeah. So it colors the mentality and spirit and let's say the souls of the our elites as well. That's kind of why we're at this point after 60 years of devouring mother stuff, where it's just a competency crisis because women don't create. The feminine spirit doesn't create, it nurtures. Mm. Right? It's supposed to maintain, do like almost social maintenance. But if you invert that, then the maintenance is actually crushing. It's like, it's negative. So
there's something in there. There's something in there, Jason, that I want to ask about. No, that's okay. So when you say that that as far as what's controlling this, you think that the elites are just as much under the sway of it as everybody else. This is something that Kyle and I were talking about yesterday that I've been thinking about when it comes to this idea of the spirit of the age of the zeitgeist. I get this image in my head of a flock of starlings. You've all seen those beautiful shapes that they're making as they're flying through the air and their numbers. Nobody's controlling that ship. No one person is steering that ship, and yet they're doing this thing collectively. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me of studying the postmodernists. We did that in the early days of the podcast, trying to get a better handle on it. And Michel Foucault said this thing, it just sticks in my head about wanting to become a part of the political will. He said he wants to have no face and to become the political will. And it's this collectivist idea. And so the idea here is that individuals no longer matter. They're all cogs in a wheel moving forward in some direction, but nobody's driving the ship. So it's kind of terrifying to me, this idea of a zeitgeist, especially when you bring up the idea of the vengeful sun and some caution around that, like it's going to feel good. And that resonates with me. I feel that. There's a reactionary, vengeful thing that's in me from all of the input that I've been getting for the last 10 years that I want to feel good about it. What scares me is like this Frankenstein monster of the zeitgeist being this machine that everybody's participating in and nobody's controlling, nobody's responsible for it. And so it's sort of terrifying. I don't really know what else to say.
Well, okay. So the bitter white pill here is that there's ways of mitigating this. And I mean, I have my preferred solutions, which is, you know, go to church and talk to a priest. But let's put that to the side. Two of the easy things you can do is take responsibility. So in Girardian mimetics, this is why monadism, what Foucault is describing, Gnosticism, never works. This return to an all one, right, where we all become sludge people. This is what communism and all these other things are trying to do. The reason, and even liberalism in its final forms, which is beyond communism, fascism, it's beyond all that. It's actually liberalism itself, right? Nominalism, individualism. Individualism is a weird one, right? Because individualism is purporting to you that you are very important, right? You can be separate from everything else. You are not collective. You stand alone. The problem with that is that's a lie. The person that is you is a collective representation of everything that has come before you. You represent your society, your culture, your time, your family, your lineage, your religion, your whatever, right? All these things is represented in you. So yes, you have a persona, you have a uniqueness that is, you know, you are not me and I am not you, this we can say. But in terms of this idea of hyper-individualism, it's a lie. And actually what happens with individualism, because you need models, right? You need to know who, how to be in the world, because otherwise, if you're, you're a father, right? You know this.
Yes.
You model behavior to your children. You can tell them a million things. They'll ignore everything you say, but they will do what you do. Yes. So, or how you do it. And they will do it in such a, such a refined way, because they live with you and their entire existence depends on it. So yes. you are the representation of reality to your child. You are the representation of what a man is to your child, not just a father, like the whole category. So this idea of monism, that you can return to some sort of like one, well, what's the one? Who is the one? What is the one we're returning to? What is it? Give me the model. Just show me, right? You can't. No one can. It's why it fails. Because we can't all be one without giving up who we are. And that's the problem with individualism, is that by having no strict model, the individual, right, cut out liberal individual idea becomes the model. But it shifts all the time. The liberal ideal when I was growing up is completely different than what it is today. So if you're my age and you're trying to shift to maintain this ideal, you go crazy. It explains a whole lot of why a whole lot of men and women from like, who are, I'm 47. So imagine anyone born post 1960, you know, a lot of those people are unhinged, man, or getting really angry. Because the contradictions that this is building up in your head starts to unravel yourself. It's at some point, it's like you either go crazy or you find religion, or in my case, probably a bit of both. But sorry, I'm going on. But
so how do you feel about the idea, about this idea that this monadism that we're talking about is a religious instinct to become one? To me is a religious instinct, because that oneness ultimately is God, and replacing that with a communal identity is a bastardization of a religious instinct. How do you feel about that idea?
Monadism is pride. Okay. It's the same pride that brought down Lucifer. It's the same pride that was spoken to Adam and Eve in the garden. Their sin was not just of disobedience, but it was of pride, right? Because what monadism always, what Gnosticism always comes back to, and there's different versions of this, but essentially we can synergize it this way, is that we were all once one God, right? Well, one being of divine essence and abilities, and at some point it got split, and we need to return back to the one to get all these superpowers. Right, we will become gods on Earth, and you know, be able to do amazing magical things and fly and shit. Right, yeah. That's monadism, Gnosticism. That's the promise. The problem with that is that it's satanic. So, and I'm not just being glib here. Like I'm being very serious,
Jason. Yeah. You are shitting in Chris's Wheaties bad right now.
No, not at all.
But it's important to get this right. It's important to get this right. Like I urge Chris, read Girard, right? Get into Girard, even just listen to the stuff, right? It's the problem with Hinduism and Buddhism and all these other things, is that again, you need a model. Human beings need to have a model. They need to know who to be and how to be. In the Christian message, even if you're going to say it's all just a story, which I disagree with, but let's just say, right? And now look, I was an atheist for 32 years, man. Like, I've come hard to these truths. Like, it wasn't easy for me to accept a lot of this stuff. But it was one of those things where once certain things started to fall into place, then everything else had to fall into place just for me to be consistent. If we need to have a model to know how to be, then that explains why in the Christian message, God is incarnate as Christ, and Christ is the model. Christ tells us how to be. Now, can we ever be as perfect as Christ? No, that's not the point. The point is to model Christ as much as you can in every single way, because if you're going wrong, then you go, all right, how do I correct this? What do I do? Well, be more like Christ, right? Sure. Like, and we're into Great Lent. Like, this is a whole ritual of basically acting out the Gospels in some ways, both in action and in prayer and all the rest of it. That's the strength of it. Even atheists, even I was a hardcore atheist, right? Even atheists have to say that Christ is, the character is heck of a guy, right? Like, if you're going to be like anyone, being like Christ, not so bad, right?
Sure.
With monadism and all those rest of it, even like, okay, Hinduism, who are you supposed to be like? Shiva? Like, that sounds horrible. Amen, which is like, it's vague. It's in Buddhism, it's like you're going to be like what they call it? Yeah, the no self, or they go back to the to essence. It's like, okay, how do I model essence? How do I model the universe? How? What do I do? How, like, if my mom is dying, how do I model the universe to be helpful to her and my family? How, my child's going through something, needs correction or something like that. I don't know what to do. I'm overburdened with suffering in my life. I go be a star. Like, what the fuck am I supposed to do? Sorry, swear on your podcast, but like,
you want to, brother. We are an adult podcast.
I'm trying to.
Yeah, I hear you.
I didn't give up swearing for Lent, but I'm monitoring myself more.
Same, but it's fucking difficult.
It's fucking difficult.
It is, yes.
But that's my point, right? So with the vengeful son, because this is a spirit that is just is going to be, let's say, coloring things. We're looking for models. So when we're starting to see this thing with Elon Musk, a lot of young boys are modeling Elon Musk.
Sure.
Right? Who was it we were talking to recently? I can't remember. Talking to someone recently, and someone was talking about this and said, Matt Erickson was on. Shout out to Matt Erickson at King Pilt. Everyone should go check that out. Podcast out. He's a great man. He was talking to AA, and he was, I think they talked about the vengeful son or something like this. And someone, AA was at first was kind of pushing back on this idea of modeling, and then was like, oh, wait, no, but I was out with my kid, and all these young boys were wearing like Elon Mars t-shirts and stuff. And some kid was saying, Elon Musk is the most smartest man in the whole world, right? Like, this is modeling. So if Elon Musk is possessed of, or starting to show signs of, or doing things in the spirit of the vengeful son, those kids will do things in the spirit of the vengeful son. My theory, and this is something that Matt and I've talked about with the PayPal mafia and stuff, is that Peter Thiel, who is a student of Girard, and who knows his shit, let's put it that way, is the mimetic model behind the mimetic models. He's the moderator. He's the mediator. He's telling people what to desire. He's the guy behind J.D. Vance. He's the guy behind Matt Gaetz. He's the guy with what's his name, Masters. A lot of other people in the Senate and Congress are all Peter Thiel guys, not just funded, but personal friends and attachés. Let's say, mm-hmm. Okay, you go through the VC world, right, and it's just rife. The guy who runs Palantir, little mini Peter Thiel. You can go down the list of people who look like Peter Thiel, who act like Peter Thiel, who have the same politics as Peter Thiel. This is all changing. It's to the point, and Peter Thiel, by the way, is connected with Yarvin. Well, why is Vivek out there talking Yarvin talking points? See? Models. Models within models within models. You follow the models back, you find out who the models are modeling. And again, when you introduce this idea of the spirit of the vengeful son, now you're going to get the kind of mood, the vibe of the next 50, 60 years. And that's where we have to navigate.
So while we're talking about models, we're talking about Christ. Is it fair to say that that model is love and sacrifice, if I'm just boiling it down?
That's part of it.
I mean, I wonder how that, how we combat.
I would say humility is the, humility is really the, if we're going to boil it all down, I mean, there's lots there, but let's just use humility as one of the big ones, because humility defeats pride. It's a counterbalance of pride. Pride in, so in Orthodoxy, we talk about the passions, and the passions are sort of like original sins. You probably heard of those.
Sure.
Gluttony, lust, vainglory. Vainglory and pride are very connected. I made this, I had a major breakthrough listening to Father Tuber Quayle's talk about this and saying that depression is a form of pride, because you're saying, oh, things didn't work out the way I wanted to, so now I'm a sad boy, right? That's pride, because the idea is like, well, who the fuck are you? Like, what do you mean you, things didn't work out for you? How do you know? Like, okay, yeah, things suck now, but you might have to get through this suck to get better at not sucking, and then all of a sudden you start conquering the world next week. Like, you don't know, right? So I would say that, like, what people don't think appreciate in the story, and it's why it was such a powerful conversion tool, is that never before and never since has a God as powerful as God ever come down in human form and humiliate and basically been humiliated or humbled himself to that point.
Sure.
All right. Zeus never did that. Zeus would come down and, you know, be a fawn, fuck around, produce some like demigods, go back up to Mount that, you know, like all through all mythology. It's why Gerard says that Christ's story breaks mythology, because that kind of humility from a God never been seen before. So
one of the things that I wanted to ask you, and you've kind of made it clear already, is the vengeful son something that we can engage with? I mean, obviously we can, but is there any way to harness it for, you know, like a positive outcome for us?
Yeah. So I'm presenting it more as a diagnostic than anything else, not a heuristic. So it's more of a, hey, this thing's happening. You might want to be aware of it. So I think the way that we use it is that it's the acknowledgement that there's a growing number, and I think it'll be pretty much totalizing in the West, especially, of young men who are very, very angry and they want to do something. They need to do something. They just don't know what to do. Mm. And they're going to be targeted and moved by people who have their own desires of what they want them to do. So what's incumbent upon us, A, is to not fall prey to it, to know what's going on and go, oh, okay, no, right? And the other thing is to then take that same energy, acknowledge it, look for these men and go, hey, wait, we got something positive for you to do, which we get into civilizational capital if you want, but that, yes. And I'm not saying, I'm not being prideful here saying I have the cure. Come on to me. I will save you. It's more like, look, this is one way of doing it. There can be multiple ways of doing it. And I encourage anyone to figure that out. But Matt Erickson and I have been building on this idea, that this concept that I came to about civilizational capital, and basically saying that we don't live in a civilization anymore, and it's up to us to start building one. Mm-hmm. And if you start from that premise and follow us along on that, on this one, it will give you something to do that's positive, that will be generational. So you can set the win ratio beyond your life, which I think is very important, to have something to not just shoot for in the here and now, but something to shoot for generationally. Mm-hmm. It helps with the whole having kids thing. And it will, I think if we pull it off, will produce beneficial results in the future. I mean, that's the hope, right? Well, I don't know.
So
I can't control things, but
touching on civilizational capital and kind of bringing the vengeful sun into it in a way that I've been, you know, soaking up a lot of your content over the last 2 weeks about those
God bless,
two things.
God bless you. That's
I've been really in
a wild ride, man.
The way that you and Matt have been, you know, kind of blowing up over the last couple of months, it's been making me really happy, man. I love seeing you guys on other people's shows, on other, you know, bigger shows. It's great.
That's all Matt. I am riding that man's coattails, basically. I'm just in pole position going, Matt, you get on those shows and hopefully I get mentioned and then I get an invite somewhere down the line. That's kind of where I'm at.
I would love to get Matt on here to talk to this guy about a lot of that stuff too. The more theological stuff that you guys were talking about. But in the content that I've been consuming, one of the things that you talked about was on Buck Johnson's show, who everyone should be listening to, Counterflow with Buck Johnson. That guy's great. But you were talking about scooping out the dunnies. And like, the idea is that, like, with civilizational capital, we have to maintain, you know, we can't let things get out of hand. And I'm prone to that, man. I'm prone to depression and melancholy. And I let things get away from me. And it has ruined a lot of the things that I've cared about in my life, you know? And I think one of the ways that it seems like we can not engage negatively with the spirit of the vengeful sun is what you mentioned earlier, is being humble. Don't look for a scapegoat. You know, you take your responsibility, take your medicine. And Pete Quinones put something out, a clip from one of his upcoming episodes. And he was talking about, this was in relation to women, but it applies to all of us. Fix it. You know, whatever those problems are, fix it.
It's what I've been saying. If you see a lot of my tweets recently, people have been going at, you know, this, that, and the other. I'm like, no. Here's your problem. Fix it.
Yeah. You
know, I've been calling it stupid loser ant smell. So I'm just decided this year, this is a year where we get rid of stupid loser ant smell from our space. So anyone exhibiting any, if I get a whiff of it, I'm like, nope, fix. Okay. Here's the thing. Here's where you're not seeing it. Fix it. If you want an ethno state, you're stupid. Get away. Like it's, I'm not having these discussions anymore. I'm not debating. This isn't debate. Like, I've so many times people go, that's not an argument. I'm not arguing with you. I'm telling you. No, I'm telling you. Now, you can accept that or not. You can listen to me or not. You can exert your free will in these wonderful ways. But I'm telling you, I'm not debating you or presenting something and going, what do you think, guys? I'm telling you, this is what this is. Okay. I'm an obsessive thinker. All I do when I'm not on these shows and talking is think. Like, it's not a great way of being. I don't recommend it, but it's just how I am. So trust me, even if I'm wrong or if you disagree or something like that, whatever I'm saying, I have thought about obsessively for at least 30, 40 hours before I even give it voice. So, and I'm not saying that that makes me right. It just means that, like, I've thought this through. So you're going to have to come at me with something really, really good for me to go, let me consider that, right? Like, I'm presenting you a position, and this is the position I'm taking for the foreseeable future. So it's like, either you get on board or you don't. I don't care. I think that's the thing people don't realize about me, is like, I legitimately don't give a shit. Like, you know, people go, oh, you're going to lose viewers from the dissident rhyme. I don't care. This isn't a popularity contest. I don't give a shit. It's like, you're either on board and helping or you're not. That's it. Those are your options with me. And, you know, God bless. It's
so the idea awesome. With the humility thing, it's like, if the spirit of the vengeful sun has got a hold of you and you are blaming everyone else, you're going to, that vengeful sun energy is going to lash out at those people, and you're likely going to do something terrible. But if you can be humble and acknowledge your own problems, then maybe you can channel that kind of vengeful sun energy into the building of civilizational capital that you were talking about before. And ever since that J.D. Vance article came out that Matt did a stream on. I've been very interested in that guy, and I downloaded the audiobook of Hillbilly Elegy. And this part jumped out at me. It's right in the beginning of the book. I'm just going to read a little excerpt from it. He's talking about working in a tile warehouse and the boss not being able to find good employees. There's a guy who's, he's a bum. He's a terrible employee. So he writes this. You can't ignore stories like this when you talk about equal opportunity. Nobel-winning economists worry about the decline of the industrial Midwest and the hollowing of the economic core of working whites. What they mean is that manufacturing jobs have gone overseas and middle-class jobs are harder to come by for people without college degrees. Fair enough. I worry about those things too. But this book is about something else, what goes on in the lives of real people when the economy goes south. It's about reacting to bad circumstances in the worst way possible. It's about the culture that increasingly encourages social decay instead of counteracting it. The problems that I saw in the tile warehouse run far deeper than macroeconomic trends and policy. Too many young men immune to hard work, good jobs impossible to fill for any length of time, and a young man with every reason to work, a wife to be, a baby on the way, carelessly tossing away a good job with excellent health insurance. More troublingly, when it was all done, he thought something had been done to him. There is a lack of agency here, a feeling that you have little control over your life, and a willingness to blame everyone but yourself. And that just like jumped out at me a lot in terms of the whole vengeful son energy. Like that guy is going to be possessed by the vengeful son. And like I said, do something terrible. You know, that's
I don't know if he's going to do, I don't know if he'll do something terrible or not.
But I mean, to me, that seems like the energy of a guy who gets fired and comes back and shoots his boss. You know what I mean? maybe.
I'm not saying
that's definitely going to happen, but
if the boss is the deep state, yeah, probably. That's the danger, right? The danger, some of the other examples, of course, is there's a guy I think in Chile who got out of his car, he was like, looked like he's in his mid to late 50s, or you know, just a guy, right? Normal dude, got out of his car with a gun and shot an environmental protester to death who was blocking up the road. That's vengeful son, mm-hmm. right? So there is a very dark, violent, kinetic violence that can happen. I think things like, we didn't get into Neo-Trad, and I don't know if you have enough time, but there's other things that are coming along the pipe that I think that'll mitigate things. But regardless, here's the thing that again, the danger is it's going to feel good. The other danger is thinking this is going to fix it. It's not. The problems are still all in front of us. The issue is this. If you want to really combat vengeful son, liberalism, all these things, stop being resentful. The way you stop being resentful is take responsibility. You are the problem in your life. Fix it.
Yep.
Go fix yourself.
Yep.
Any way you want to. I have my preferred ways and methods. You are the problem. Okay. Father Seraphim Rose once wrote for Orthodoxy, is that the proper position for all Orthodox practitioners is to believe that they are the worst sinner. You are the worst sinner in the world has ever existed. Okay. Everyone else is GFY, go fix yourself. Yeah, actually, that's good, Trey. We'll use that. Everyone else, you forgive everybody else. You find a reason to forgive everyone else for what they're doing, even the worst sins, right? Find a way to say, it's not their fault, it's this or that, right? It's not excusing them. It's just that in your mind and in your heart, it's better to forgive them and take it all on you. Because you can fix you. This is Jordan Peterson, clean your room stuff, right? But on the next level, where it's like, look, don't go blaming the government. The government put all the jobs out and shipped all your jobs out. Okay, well, why didn't you get another job that couldn't be shipped out? Why was your next move to go to another factory and go, oh, they did it again? Yeah, they did it again. And they'll do it again and do it again and do it again. Like, this is where the vengeful sun energy can come into focus, and we can kind of tap in a little bit of that, which is like, are you angry? Yeah, me too. You know who I'm angry at? Me. I'm angry at me that I got led, that I led myself down a garden path, right? Got betrayed. But who betrayed me? Me. And I can blame everybody else under the sun, but I'm the one who made the decisions. I'm the one who saw the negative impacts that my decisions were having and went, oh, well, you know, best, it's not the best system, but it's the best one we got. Bullshit. If it's not the best system, then fix it. Fix or it. Make a better one. Do something. Build, motherfucker.
Don't just like, fucking don't, complain.
Right. Don't sit here and go, but the fucking Jews and the Bucks and the immigrants. Don't. Here's the thing, right? They're importing. Right, the whole immigration problem. I get it, man. And I'm not saying, hey, importing cannibals is a great freaking solution to your country. At the same time, it's like they have an average IQ of 60 fucking five. That's like outthinking a gorilla. So if you're telling me that you, you know, magical white person in the West can't outthink a fucking gorilla, then you don't deserve to make it. Figure it out. Build something.
There's a certain type of person that this message lands with, and Jordan Peterson's audience is a perfect example. But there's another section, there's another demographic that will never think to themselves, it's me and I should do something. You know, how do we get to those people?
We don't. I'm not interested in getting, this isn't a spreading the message. I'm not converting. This is my point. Right. I'm presenting the situation as it is. You don't live in a civilization anymore. If that upsets you, you should figure out why it upsets you. And if it upsets you, because ultimately it's true, then Matt and I and a few others are coming up with ways, and that hasn't hit the main yet. If you go follow the civilization patchwork and civilization playlist on our YouTube, on my YouTube channel, a 2-bit podcast, you can see where we're going with it. We're basically trying to find synergism between what Yarvin was writing about in 2008 and with our program, because I think Yarvin, there's a lot of overlaps.
Like fucking prophet, man. I've been starting at the beginning of Unqualified Reservations and reading just it chronologically. The shit that he's talking about in 2007 like blows my socks off, man. It's crazy.
It's pretty rebel. I mean, patchwork especially. And here's the thing: when you see what Peter Thiel and a lot of the investment guys are doing in Honduras, in El Salvador, in Argentina, because who's behind these people? Who's funding these people? Who's giving them protection? Why has Bukele not been assassinated yet? Well, if you dig into who's funding him, you find out it's like Palantir and a whole bunch of other private interests who are big and powerful, who can make sure that he doesn't get touched, right?
Yep.
Yarvin said in the opening of Patchwork that even if someone starts doing this in a third world country, right, it will soon overtake. It'll be like West Germany competing with East Germany. It'll overtake it. And what are you seeing? Well, you're seeing a bunch of Westerners looking at Bukele going, I like that.
Yep.
Melee, I call it the Build-A-Caesar phenomena. So these guys don't have to be successful in everything. They have to be successful in one area and then model that success across the board. Yeah, so Bukele takes out the crime. Sorry? Yeah,
they also have to kiss the wall, Jason.
Yeah, they also have to kiss the wall. But, you know.
Yeah. So in terms of Rene Girard, you know, I've been digging into Girard a little bit, mostly because of you, honestly. And so you've got the vengeful son coming into being, and you've got the devouring mother who's kind of like fading out. Mm-hmm. You know, Girard has this theory about when things are changing, there's like a sacrificial murder or act of violence. And you've said that you don't think it's all going to be kinetic violence. Do you think there is going to be some kind of thing like that that signifies the switch between
there'll be a murder,
devouring mother and vengeful son?
There'll be a murder.
A murder?
Yeah. MLK was a human sacrifice that kicked off the 1960s in devouring mother.
Mm-hmm.
Who would have been? Oh, Ferdinand. Ferdinand was the sacrifice that kicked off World War I, right?
Yep.
So There will be a murder. Who? I don't know. Probably Trump. If I were to bet, it'd probably be Trump.
It seems. I mean, they're gunning for him. You know,
they're gunning for him. That's for sure.
Yeah. Or, I mean, we'll see. Right? It might be someone we don't even think of. Maybe. Who knows? It'll be. Let's just put it this way. I don't know who. I will not speculate further. If I were to bet, I would bet on Trump. But who knows? There will be a murder, and that murder. So what Gerard says is this: is that especially in the scapegoat phenomena, the scapegoat is you. So the more alike people are, the more they become rivalrous. Mm-hmm. The problem we have with the elites and the common people, why do the elites hate us? Why are they working against us? Is that the differentiation between the elites and the common person is getting narrower and narrower because of technology, because of wealth, ability. A whole bunch of people are about to inherit their parents, their boomer parents. That's that's trillions of dollars in both insurance and all these other things that are going to now be inherited by the incoming generations. That's why they're trying to siphon this stuff off like crazy and diffuse it. Mm. Because all of a sudden, if you get let's say even 10 million, right? It doesn't have to be a huge number, right? 10 million Gen X millennials who are now sitting on millions and millions of dollars. Well, if the buy-in rate for the elites has been money so far, well, now they're in the elite structure, right? Like they can do stuff. Uh-oh, right? I think that a lot of this stuff kind of gets explained that way, but where was I going with it? Okay, so the more people are alike, the more rivalrous they become. This will lead into all violence, a totalizing violence. In order to start to diffuse the situation, a scapegoat is selected. Everyone goes, that's the problem, right? The reason why things are so bad is because of this person. In mythology, let's say you take Oedipus or something like that person is sacrificed, murdered. The things get better because, you know, totalizing violence dissipates. And then that person is then basically put into a god, is made into like a civic religion or a civic god because of it. Because it's, you know, their murder led to a boon or a golden age, or let's just say better times than it was before. Because when totalizing violence happens, all productivity just stops, right? So it's not just like, oh, everyone's upset with each other. It's like you get planes falling from the sky and like no food being produced and stuff like that, right? So suddenly that goes away and everyone goes back to work and everything feels better. So if we look at MLK, that was a kickoff, right? MLK is murdered. And that forces the government to enact civil rights, and now, if anywhere in the West, you celebrate MLK Day. You do it in Canada. You do it. People in Germany are celebrating MLK. Why? What is that? What does that have to do with them? Well, because it's a Western civic religion. So yeah, I think you're going to see it. They tried it with what's his nuts there? Floyd. That didn't work because, again, that energy of the devouring mother. MLK was the sacrifice of the devouring mother. Let's put it in those terms. So more sacrifice of the devouring mother isn't going to work. You're going to need a new sacrifice for the vengeful son. So
it does.
I would say
like Trump is the perfect,
could be Biden. Who knows? I don't know.
Does somebody dies of old age, does that count as the sacrificial? No, that doesn't work.
Right. It won't be of old age. It won't be old age. It'll be a murder.
Yeah.
It could be some international figure too. Like who knows? Maybe it's Putin. I don't know. Right. But there's going to be a murder. And it'll be an obvious murder. Like it's not going to be just like, whoops, you know, slipped on the soap. Right? Yeah. It'll be a murder. And that will kick off a new civic religion, a new culture. Let's say, because that's what the founding of all cultures comes from that murder. And you can go back to Rome with Romulus and Remus. There's tons of historical examples of this that Gerard points to. That you have the murder changes things, and people galvanize around the murder. in Christianity is Cain and Abel. And our definition of what is taboo, right, comes from the murder. So people can galvanize around a new ethos of why this was wrong or what happened, right? It can be different for different cases, but it generally just kicks off a civic religion that's set with its own taboos and rules and regulations, what is good and what is bad, all that kind of stuff. So that's, you'll look for that.
It's difficult for me not to see the death of Christ as that sort of a paradigm shifting moment.
Well, that's like key to Gerard. I mean, that's like, you know.
Yeah, one book you should check out is I See Satan Fall Like Lightning.
Okay, I'm writing it down.
Yeah.
Listen, I want to be respectful of your time, and we're at an hour, Jason. Yeah, I appreciate it. I wish I could go longer, guys.
I'm just sorry. I got to get to the day job. So,
no, I appreciate it. I think it would be tremendous to have more of a theological, philosophical conversation with you one day.
That's Chris's jam.
If that's possible. But listen, I really appreciate it. I think maybe when we brought up the archetypes and Jordan Peterson and Carl Jung a little bit earlier, maybe we can kind of conclude like this. One of the things Jordan mentions is that archetypes are bivalent. So like you mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, the devouring mother is also the great mother, and the tyrannical father is also the wise king. They're the same being. And so the vengeful son is also the archetypal son. It's also the prodigal son, like you mentioned earlier. And I think once you know that these archetypes are bivalent, but essentially one thing, you know, you can flip from yin to yang. We can flip mm-hmm. from vengeful son to prodigal son. And maybe that gives us a little bit of a hopeful key here to end on. It is possible to flip that switch from the vengeful son to the prodigal son. And be that model, that Christ-like model that the world needs.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. God bless.
Thank you, Jason.
Well, yep. If you want to, we can stay on for a little bit if you want. I mean, all right.
Yeah,
sure. Okay. All right, Jason. Thank you so much. Have a good day,
guys. Go check out 2Bit Podcast. We're on Spotify, all the podcatchers.
YouTube, I got all your links in the Rumble, in the bio. And the, you know.
Yes, give us a follow, because there's more interesting stuff coming up this month and this year. So appreciate you guys. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you for letting me just ramble. Yeah, hopefully there's some stuff gets through the ether, and I appreciate you guys.
Absolutely. Thanks, man.
All right.
We'll see you.
All right. I mean, we don't have to stay on, but we usually go longer. Is all, you know.
Let's digest this a little bit.
Yeah, it's, you know.
Let's digest it a little bit.
What do you think about all that?
It's a lot to think about. I think the idea that a sacrifice, that some sort of public sacrifice, not just a public sacrifice, but some sort of paradigm shifting sacrifice, some sort of grand gesture is going to be needed to transition from one state of our society, culture to another. I don't know whether that will be a murder. It could very well be something symbolic like that. But it has to be a sacrifice of something. And in my mind, I was thinking, you know, it's wokeism that needs to be sacrificed. And then he brings up MLK. And so in my mind, I'm thinking, if it's a murder that's required, what murder is symbolic, that would necessitate the demise of wokeism? Like, who has to die for the world to realize that wokeism is a poison and a cancer?
I mean, like I said, I think that Trump fits the bill for that. You know, like we've got this spirit of the devouring mother that is, you know, like Jason said, at its zenith with woke, you know, the whole woke phenomenon. And Trump is kind of the antithesis of that, you know, like from day one, he's been very brash, very not woke. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that he's kind of like an icon for anti-woke, if you will. And if people see that he's taken out, I can see people being like, you know, like, is what he was saying really, you know, that bad? And like Jason said, maybe that that murder, it's like things get better after that, you know what I mean? And maybe that plays into it as well.
So what concerns me about that is that is a reasonable thing to say. And I think the people that would feel, I think there is a group of people that are roughly 40-50% of the citizens of this country that would be relieved if Trump was no longer around. They would think, finally, now things can get better, because that's what you see. That's what you see in the narrative, right? It's he's a threat to democracy. You know, he's a criminal. He has the gall to continue to be in public life when all he's doing is dragging us down. And you have a big chunk of the population that seems to believe that, who would be relieved if they didn't, if they felt like they removed that obstacle, you know, from the world. But that doesn't overthrow wokeism. What would overthrow wokeism is the reactionary side, the other side saying some blue-haired lunatic in the name of wokeism assassinated the president.
Yeah.
Okay. In a situation like that, that galvanizes the other 50% of the population. It's hard for me to understand how that gets us out of the vengeful sun scenario. It seems like a galvanization of the vengeful sun scenario, to Jason's point, where now you have 50% of the population at war against the other.
I don't think it gets us out of the vengeful sun. I think it gets us out of the devouring mother, like officially.
I see. Fuck. That's even more bleak.
Yeah. There's a person in the chat, Emissary, who asked the question, has Trump already been scapegoated and divinized? And he says he's new to Gerard, but he thought that exile would be similar to murder. And I mean, I could see, you know, if they put Trump in prison, that's kind of like an exile, you know, so that could be. And I mean, he's already kind of been exiled. Like he's, I don't know, in some ways, like socially exiled. He's like a deplorable. He's an untouchable. You're not even allowed. You express any like affinity for him or the things that he says, and that's a fucking problem.
True.
You know?
And if you are exiled, I'm thinking of like Napoleon in this instance on the island of Elba, whatever. When you are in that situation, you lose everything you have. You lose your possessions. You lose your titles. You lose, you know, and they're trying to take Trump Tower from that dude. They're making him come up with $500 million to not go to jail. They're taking things from him, you know. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting way of thinking about it.
Yeah, for sure. Let's see here. I had some other stuff written down here. And this is stuff that we kind of talked about the other day. In a lot of the content that I've been, you know, soaking up of Jason and Matt, you know, they're talking about the civilizational capital and just kind of tied back into the how this got started with Jason responding to that Asha Logos episode. Yep. Jason says that it's not an exclusively racial thing, mm-hmm. you know, and a lot of like the people who want an ethno state, they want to make it completely racial. But if you dropped us off in the Amazon, we would have to get primal, yep. you know, it's just a necessity. But I do think that obviously, if you look at, the way things are going in our culture, there is some kind of a racial aspect to it, because there's been a group throughout the history of the world, pretty much, who has been we've excelled at developing civilizational capital. I say I have developed no civilizational capital, but it's the progeny of the Proto-Indo-European people. You know, that group of people started out, you know, somewhere in Eastern Turkey, somewhere in the Caucasus Mountains, maybe. And they spread out in all directions and they built amazing, amazing cultures, amazing societies. And you look at, like I said, the way things are going in, you know, this devouring mother era of culture, and we're not allowed to be proud of that. We're not allowed to want to get back to that, because if we get back to that, it, you know, we're colonizers, we're evil, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, Jason was talking about how the spirit of the age, it's beyond like the elites. And that's pretty much the page I was on too. It's like, you can't control it. It's going to control a bunch of people. The best you can maybe do is make yourself not immune to it, but you know, you can try to be in control a little bit. And I just wonder, how the vengeful sun is going to make itself, make itself felt in those kind of areas. You know what I mean? Like, we're seeing all these videos. I see like one every day, it seems like, of some white person just getting stomped, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I wonder, I'm not rooting for it. You know, I think it would be terrible, but I do wonder, like, how is that going to play out? Will there be any kind of resolution to that? These are potentially scary things to think about.
They are scary things. I think it's not unrealistic to think that we might have something akin to the race riots, in reverse. I'm not saying that like I want that to happen. What I'm saying is that is a near and present danger. Mm. It's something that the conditions are creating. It's a reactionary spirit, and vengeance is a great word for it. Vengeance is like it's a motivational force. It's like anger. It gives you energy. You know, it's like you could be, you know, beat down to a pulp and exhausted, but if you have enough fucking rage, you're going to pick yourself back up and tooth and claw. You know, it's like, it's a spirit, and it's scary. It's scary that it's being stoked. And the way it's being stoked, it's like what you brought up earlier about being called colonizers and Nazis and things like that, merely for being proud of our heritage.
And for not wanting our society to crumble.
Right, know? Right. Especially when we're to a point where we aren't colonizers and haven't been in a very long time. Mm-hmm. We certainly aren't Nazis. It's like we can't win. We can't, you know, it's like painting people into a corner, you know? And what happens when you do that? You're going to bring out the worst in people. And it's a dangerous thing. And I don't understand the tactics unless that's what you're aiming for.
Yeah. So you've seen all this stuff in the news about Boeing.
Yeah.
All the panels flying off jets in the middle of the air, landing gear not coming down, mm-hmm, just a bunch of things. I don't want to go anywhere. I don't want to travel anywhere that requires a plane right now.
Yep.
And you know, they kind of talk about that in terms of a competency crisis.
Yeah.
And one of the ideas that Jason has talked about pretty frequently, it's an idea that he got from Nick Land, who is a dissident right kind of political thinker, philosopher, is that competency develops capital. You know, like if you're competent, you're going to accrue capital in some way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you look at the competency crisis, it doesn't seem to be natural. You know, it seems to be being forced in some way. And I don't know what the motivations for that are. You know, we could speculate, but it doesn't. It seems like we're being steered in that direction of being less having people who are less competent in positions where we need people who are competent.
Sure. I don't think there's a difference between the word merit and competency. It's like they're equivalent things. And the fact that equity is now the goal and not meritocracy, that's a factory that's going to churn out incompetence. You're selecting people not for competence. And so the game is rigged against competence. Mm-hmm. And I agree with you. I see that. I look at our politicians and I think to myself, Jesus Christ, this is the best we could do. I also think about the labor market. I think about the types of things we're doing in this country. You know how it's like you can't find a good plumber, you can't find a good electrician, you can't find a good welder, because that's not what the society has been encouraging for the last 50 years. It's been encouraging people to go to college and learn different sort of service industries, lawyers and finance, and they wanted the United States to no longer be a place where things are built. You know, all the manufacturing's gone away. You know, we live in the Midwest, we see that all the time. But it didn't come to fruition. There's not enough college degrees and service jobs and that sort of technical competence to give everybody a good living.
Yeah.
And so we've tried and failed to do that. Now college degrees don't mean shit. And we don't have people that can do things anymore. And that's part of the competency crisis. It's not related to equity exactly, but it's working in conjunction with it.
Yeah. They definitely seem to be hand in hand. Let's see here. I think that is actually pretty much all I had as far as notes go. We could get into civilizational capital a little bit, but, maybe we'll be able to get Jason back on eventually, and we can go into civilizational capital a little bit deeper.
Yeah. Well, so when Jason and I had that little moment where we were talking about the monad and the oneness, and you chimed in about shitting all over my Sierra. So I agreed with Jason all the way up to the point where he said that people in that vein think that that achieving a oneness is going to give you magical powers, right? That achieving a oneness is something that is a selfish Luciferian impulse. That's where I think we could have a more productive conversation, because I know that people like that exist in the New Age movement and things like that.
Yeah, I would say that you, because I know we've talked about it a lot. I know your kind of your track on that sort of thing, and I would say that it's well established that I can't go fully to where you're going.
Yeah,
but I know that you are not as like that as a lot of people who believe that kind of Gnostic monadism kind of thing. But like almost everyone else is, you know, like almost everyone else has that kind of a thing.
So he brought up Hinduism in that context. And the Atman is Brahman. All of us are God sort of thing. And that's the oldest tradition where it comes from. It's a 5,000 year old religion that believes that. I don't think those people believe that they are being self-serving or trying to achieve something for themselves by recognizing their oneness with Brahman. I think that is the most selfless thing. It is to give up the self to become one with the universe. So I would have a very different take on how historically that idea should be understood. I think that even the Gnostic movement maybe has some groups and some people that are more along those lines, and others that are more along the lines of the New Agey folks, like the Rudolf Steiners and the New Agey folks. I would have a hard time thinking that the majority of people that believe spirituality and at-one-ment and that sort of thing is the goal of the spiritual experience are doing something for themselves to gain some sort of power because of pride. And I that really, really seems unlikely. It's so contrary to my experience. I really struggle with that.
Yeah. I think that just because you honestly believe something doesn't mean that you're not wrong. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
So I don't know enough about those traditions to really speak on it. You know what I mean?
I'm willing to be wrong. I'm willing to learn.
I guess you do believe that. So I guess I am talking about you, but like, in the like Hindu religion, like just because those people believe that they are not, it's not Luciferian, doesn't mean that it's not, you know what I mean? It, just because you believe something doesn't mean that you're not wrong, you know?
So there's these folks in Hinduism, they're just called gurus generally, but they're like, they come in all shapes and sizes. And some of them are exactly like Jason described. There are people that pretend to be holy. They've achieved some state that makes them better than everybody else. And people pay them for blessings, and people like give them alms, and like they basically survive off of the quote unquote charity of the people around them. But then there are others that are like Mother Teresa, you know. Mm-hmm. There are others that literally live to be a sacrifice to the rest of humanity, and that is what I think is the genuine root of that. Unitive oneness that
I understand what you mean, but I also think that you picked Mother Teresa, and I don't think that Mother Teresa, I think that she would be more on the boat with me, you know, like she could go with you up to a certain point, but beyond that point, it's a no go for us. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It would be an interesting chat with Mother Teresa. I'd like to have her, I'd like to have her on the podcast.
Maybe in the afterlife.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I had a feeling, that kind of stuff was going to come up, and I would definitely love to hear you guys talk about that.
I would too. Absolutely. I mean, I'm not married to my ideas, but I'm convinced by some of them, and I'm willing to change my mind. But what's most interesting to me is the idea that I could talk through this with somebody who's on your side of the fence, and without arguing, with genuinely trying to understand one another, find out how much we really disagree, you know. Yeah. Just try to do that.
Yeah. Well, I think we could probably work that out with someone. So somebody who is more, you know, well, theologically versed than I am, you know, like I've been in the church a long time. I grew up, you know, started out in the church when I was a very small child. I know a lot of the stories, like, better than a lot of people. But as far as in terms of how you apply that to your life and the deeper meaning of it all, I'm still learning, you know, I'm still picking a lot of that up.
How do you think religion plays into this idea of civilizational capital? Because different religions have different value structures that they impose on people. And, I imagine that the religion being in the religio, or whatever it was, the word that Jason used, that's the thing at the top of the hierarchy that organizes society that we're all moving towards, that makes us a society. It's the thing that unifies us. And if that religion is different, if that model is different, then it changes the civilization based upon it. Mm-hmm. So how do you think religion plays into this idea of civilizational capital? Is it the case that some religions contribute more to the advancement of civilization?
Just like off the top of your head, you don't think that's definitely, that there's one that's been pretty good?
Seems that way, right?
Yeah. And I think that Jason kind of said a couple of times, and, you know, he restricted himself from going in too deep into it, because a lot of times people who aren't Christian, it's like if you start Jesusing them to death, they like check out a little bit, you know, and
for sure.
And if you want people to, you know, be open to the idea of the vengeful son and civilizational capital, you don't want to like tap them out immediately, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that Jason and I completely agree that, yeah, we should be orienting ourselves towards living a Christian life. That the society we live in would be better off if that was the aim that we were shooting for, you know? So that's kind of where I think religion comes into it.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I think that in America, we're not going to be able to force everyone to be Christian. You know what I mean? We're not going to do like they did in Spain during the Inquisition. And it's like, we're baptizing you and you're fucking Christian now, you know, or you die. You know, I don't think that's good, but I do think that we can organize our civilization in a way that says you believe whatever you want, but you can't subvert the binding ethos of our society, and you can't be out in public doing things that are contrary to that, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't, you know, a few years ago, like I mentioned before, that my entire journey from being a hardcore anarcho-capitalist to being what I am now has all been documented on this podcast.
Yeah.
And in the early days, I would have had a real problem with that. You know, like, oh, you can't force me to abide by what you see as, you know, the proper religion. But now I kind of think if I build a society, and, you know, if things break down and me and a group of like-minded people build a society, why can't I tell you that you can't behave this way in my society? And if you break those rules, why can't I remove you?
Yeah, find a different society. If you don't want to be in this one, clearly you don't, find another one.
Yeah. And if my society, you know, whatever, I know it's not going to be my society. Like I said, I haven't built any civilizational capital yet. But if you look at our society and you say, man, that's good. Like what Jason was talking about with Nayib Bukele, like people are looking at that, like, that looks good. You know, like,
explain that to me, please.
The Bukele thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, in Argentina, that guy, Javier Milei, won. Okay. So Nayib Bukele is the president of El Salvador, and he came into power, and suspended the constitution basically, and rounded up any. Okay. So the violence, the gang violence was out of control in El Salvador. It was like something like just a ridiculously high number of murders per like 100,000 people, like super high.
Yeah.
And he, like I said, suspended the constitution, went out, you know, had basically a military force go out, round up all of the, you know, you got a tattoo of a number 13 on yourself. You got tattoos on your face. We're at least bringing you in and taking a good hard look at you, you know, and put tons of criminals in prison. You can find these videos of, you know, it looks like, you know, in, like when they're taking the new recruits to boot camp and they're all like in lines and they're like running, you know,
but
these are prisoners. Yeah. They're all in like white boxer shorts and shirts and, you know, and they're, you know, kind of like humiliating these people and putting them in prison. And boy, did it fucking work. I'd if shit goes south, I might move to El Salvador. It looks, it's looking nice.
Did Bukele restore like the authority, like his rightful, his limited authority after this, or did he, is he dictator?
Yeah. I mean, you know, do I want to say that he's a dictator? I don't know that I would say that. But he's definitely, I can't tell you whether or not they, you know, reestablished all of the aspects of the constitution that they have.
Yeah.
I assume that they did because I haven't heard anything really to the contrary. But all I know is that the people in El Salvador are very happy and that a lot of neighboring countries are looking at Bukele and being like, that looks pretty good.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
So when I was asking about what role religion might play in this idea of civilizational capital, I had these two things that flashed in my mind. One of them was the movie 300. I was thinking about militaristic societies like ancient Sparta, probably the Germanic tribes in the you know, pre-classical period, where strength was a super valuable trait, strength and bravery and things like that. I'm just thinking of like berserkers and shit. And at least in the case of the Spartans, people that were born with disabilities or people that were born that were weak, they were killed. They were left out in the forest, you know, to die, so that the society would remain strong as possible. And it's kind of like a eugenic sort of a idea. And there were religions that supported that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about Christianity, and I mentioned this idea of sacrifice earlier, I think that's the heart. That's the heart of Christianity. Like that's what Jesus was. He was the sacrifice. If you're going to boil it down to anything, it's love and sacrifice, in my opinion. In fact, I don't think there's a difference between the two. You know, why did Jesus sacrifice himself? Because he so loved the world, right? And you see that sacrificial theme in life. If you love something, you sacrifice for it. It's just, they just go together. They're inseparable. And I'm imagining, you know, Jesus washing the feet of his apostles, that sort of thing, humbling himself and sacrificing in that way. And in our society, it's like, if we could design a society where everybody was following that ethos of being self-sacrificial, of, you know, giving to the poor, of caring for the elderly, of caring for the disabled, versus the society that takes those disabled babies and leaves them in the forest. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I have this sort of challenge in my mind right now where I think about the Christian version of this sounding a bit like, I want to say communism, but maybe like an idealist version that actually worked, you know, because we never had that, where everybody's living for each other versus the Spartan idea of some kind of savage. But if those two cultures ever came to conflict with each other, who wins? Who wins in that situation? You know, it's just fucking scary. Like, I don't know exactly where I'm going with this, but what do you think?
I mean, I don't think that being a Christian necessitates that you're a pacifist. Yeah, there are Christians who believe that. I'm not one of them. So another idea in Girard is that when Christ died, he, I don't know the right way to phrase this. He like brought four, you know, values into the world. Like he made these four values, like the most important things. One of them is love. Mm-hmm. The other one is truth. The other one is innovation. And the fourth one, which kind of ties in with the vengeful son thing and is surprising. It's not, you won't expect this. It's violence. Now I'm just now digging into Girard, you know, I can't speak on it too much, but I do know that like what you were talking about with it being bivalent, the spirit, all of those values are bivalent too. It's like, love caught, you know, at first we love people and then that becomes corrupted in like what we have going on today. It's like, we love minorities and people who are on the outskirts of society so much that we like are now villainizing everyone else,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And with truth, you get the, you know, there's the like divine truth and then there's scientific truth, you know? And we have like thrown out divine truth for scientific truth. We have no, like as a society, we have no value. We don't put any value into divine truth anymore.
Right.
And what innovation, I can't really remember what the negative bivalent side of innovation is, but.
Well, you could think of a technocracy. You could
think, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. You could think of Terminator, you know, mm-hmm. You could think of that kind of thing.
Transhumanism.
Right. And the Tower of Babel was that example. That was the pinnacle of human technology at the time. You know, was building this tower to reach heaven. It's interesting.
Yeah. Do you believe that they're just as a question, not really related to what we're talking about? Do you believe that the Tower of Babel was real, or do you think that that's just a symbolic story?
I believe. I mean, my just if I'm just answering you from the gut, I believe that the Ziggurat of Ur is the Tower of Babel. I think it's literally. You could go see the rubble of it if you want.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can go see the rubble of it. But I guess the question really is, do I think that the story, the biblical story, is literally related to the Ziggurat of Ur? I mean, you know, when we went to go see Jordan Peterson the other day and, he was talking about how, people, I'm trying to remember how he put it because he's so much more eloquent than me in this regard. But he said that, you know, people end up becoming unable to speak with each other. They can't communicate with each other anymore. They're speaking different languages. And he was relating that to the Tower of Babel, but he was also relating that to our modern times. And he said, what is a woman? And he just said that, like, what is a woman? Why are we arguing about that? That is proof that we can't communicate. We're speaking different languages. And it has to do with the Tower of Babel. It has to do with our desire to supplant God in some way, our desire to be great, to be at the top of the hierarchy and to look down on everybody else. And that makes it impossible for the people that aren't like that to even speak the same language. Even if you are speaking the same language, you don't mean the same thing. You're not able to communicate the same thing. And I think that type of an understanding of the Tower of Babel story is probably literally true in the pre-classical period when civilization was first settling down and you had people who were nomadic pastoralists who were now finding themselves living in a city for the first time, trying to figure that out. I think there's probably some parallels there, but I'm not wise enough to make sense of it any more than that at the moment.
Yeah, I didn't want to dig too deep into it. I was just curious what you thought, because I know you've been kind of on a Jonathan Pageau tear recently, and he just always talks about those things super interestingly.
Yeah, man. Dude.
It's like the Bible. I believe that everything in the Bible actually happened, but I also believe that there's a symbolic meaning to all of it. And that's like kind of like right out of Jonathan Pageau, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. The symbolic understanding of those stories, that understanding kind of began with me in some ways with Jordan Peterson.
Yeah. I mean, I think tons of people.
And it expanded into Carl Jung and some of those associated people. And when you start, when you understand the point, the reason for stories like that, it's like, it's hard for me to believe that the reason that those stories exist and exist the way they do is to carry on some literal historical account, but rather to tell us the moral of the story. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the reason why we still have Aesop's Fables. It's the reason why I got the Brothers Grimm and fucking, where is it at? Hans Christian Andersen over there, because those stories tell you something important and valid, eternally valid, right? It doesn't matter how times change and culture changes. The morals of those stories are valid, and understanding the spiritual significance, I don't think there's a difference between saying the spiritual significance and the psychological meaning.
Right on, man. All right, man. Well, I don't have a whole lot else to talk about, but like I said, I just wanted to get a little extra. And normally we go a little bit longer than an hour.
Well, big thanks again to Jason from 2Bit Podcast for coming on. Check him out if you haven't done it already. And
you got anything? Yeah. So you just put out Amit Goswami episode. Yeah. Go talk. What's that called?
It's called
Self-Aware Universe.
The Self-Aware Universe.
Go check that out. Subscribe. Hit that like button, subscribe, ring the bell, do all the things.
Do all the things.
We got our Twitter handles up there. Follow us there and reach out to us, you know, if you think any of this stuff is interesting, because I think that having Jason on, a lot of the people who listen, because you've kind of developed like a little bit of a listener group, you know?
Sure, yeah.
We were talking yesterday about how our, like, online presence doesn't really cross over all that much, you know.
Very true.
And I think it's funny actually too, in the earliest days of this podcast I said that it was going to be interesting because I'm so much more of a creature of the internet.
Yes,
than you are.
You did, you
and
did.
I'm 100% positive that there was a bunch of stuff that Jason said that you had no idea what he meant.
Oh,
enough
sure.
to like follow along in the conversation. Yeah, but yeah, like yeah. The detail, like you asked me about Nayib Bukele, you
yeah.
know, like
yeah,
just
yeah.
not really not on to that, you know.
But there's many times I looked over at you like, what does this dude mean?
Explain that later. Yeah. All right, but you know, that's it. I do have I've been slow with the solo episodes, but I got some stuff in the works. I got some people coming on.
Hell yeah.
And some ideas for some episodes. So look out for that.
I'm so happy to hear that.
Yes indeed. All right. Love you guys.
See ya.